Hello and welcome to another fun-filled, action-packed adventure that is the VFX show. I'm Matthew Graham and today I'm joined by Jason Wingrove. Hello, Jason.
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm extremely happy to be here in this wonderful country I like to call Australia.
It is a sweeping adventure today because we're talking about possibly the largest budget Australian film ever made. Or
Most
it is
certainly.
The largest budget Australian film ever made.
Yep.
It started off large and went larger.
We are talking about Australia, Baz Luhrmann's latest epic, which has hit the screens recently. And I think it's an epic tale of 3 hours, and apparently could have been longer.
What is the actual running time?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but it felt like a good 4 hours.
It's the film that felt like it was going to end about three times and then kept going.
Yes.
Look, I didn't really have a problem with the length. Maybe it could have been longer. I don't know. Maybe it needed to have a bit more information in there. I don't know. For me, I think it was fairly flawed. I still think if people are asking me what do I think about it, I say still go and see it. It's a very big. It's very ambitious. It's very Baz, very theatrical.
He does like that kind of vaudevillian kind of evil person chasing after hero rescuing Dane.
It's a very polarizing film. I know a lot of people who have loved it and a lot of people who have hated it. There's bits I liked about it and there's bits I didn't like about it. Overall, I spent a majority of the film being taken out of the film by the effects, which obviously is part of what we're here to talk about, but you can't really separate the effects from the film, really. It's one big package when you walk out the door.
Especially for this one, because they were trying to stylize the effects to match that fantasy kind of faraway land feel of it. So they are intrinsically entwined. I've been told 165 minutes
right.
is the total running time.
Okay. So, yeah, that's not too bad. Not quite 3 hours then, is it?
It felt like 3 hours. I'm willing to go with the 3 hours.
Yeah, well, look, the whole fantasy thing for me, I suppose, is where I kind of have a problem with it, I guess. It has a very, very much that Moulin Rouge fantasy sort of feel over the top of what is a really gritty, realistic, harsh environment. So I think for me, I mean, obviously when you're talking about something like Moulin Rouge, you're immediately into a totally fantasy world.
Yep.
You're mixing 80s pop songs with, you know, the world of Toulouse-Lautrec and the Moulin Rouge. So really, you know from the beginning that you're in for a total fantasy ride, and the whole sort of matted, miniature, motion control kind of mix of styles, really, you know, it all works well together because you're just totally immersed in this fantasy world. But the problem is that a lot of that sort of is applied to this harsh environment of the Australian outback.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I didn't know. You know, there was all this talk about whether or not the film's ending was recut and he was, you know, cutting up to the very final moment and that's why the film doesn't feel completely finished. But for me, that's not a reason. He's had the time to make the film and the film should be complete when it gets to the finishing line. I mean, no film is ever complete. Every director will always tell you that.
Absolutely.
But I just think this one could have been a bit tighter. I mean, like, the beginning, it has a kind of Moulin Rouge-esque feel about the fast chopping, fast cuts, over-dramatised, beautiful colours, yada, yada, yada.
Mm.
And then that style completely disappears for the end.
Yeah.
So is he trying to do too many different films? Did he try doing one film at the beginning? Because I know he started off by shooting all that location stuff and then worked his way back down to Fox Studios in Sydney and did many, many retakes and pickups. So
yeah. I think I can totally, and from understanding sort of Baz's sort of backstory and what he was trying to achieve, which is that classic old Howard Hawks studio feel of doing your sweeping exterior shots for real and then cutting into close-ups, which are a mixture of background plates and foreground actors all shot on green screen. However,
with classic glass plates kind of thing.
However,
yeah.
This is where I call this film Indie 4 with cows. Because it didn't work for Indie 4 and it didn't really work for this film for me, unfortunately. And it's partly because, again, that whole... Every time I saw somebody, you know, like you cut from a wide shot to cut into interactions, say cutting two reverses together, you've got actors clearly against green screen because the backgrounds never really mate with the foreground elements for me. And the, again, this is me just sort of talking partly as a director, but partly as a, you know, just as a film, a casual film goer. I think the backgrounds really felt like they were shot with a completely different lens, or were far too out of focus. I'm all for sort of shallow depth of field, but this was forced shallow depth of field,
And not so much. I didn't feel a sense of continuity between various shots. Like, let's look at the. I think we should look at the film in a sense of two halves. There's the first half where everything's happy and we're out on the homestead and all. We've got all that angst happening out there, and then we go back to Darwin for, you know, pre and post bombing. But for me, I found the second half stronger for the visual effects and, in some respects, the story. Whereas the first was driven by trying to build up the characters, and it kind of felt as if they were staple gunning bits and pieces together to get us to the next part of it. And that's why for me, you could really tell the stuff that was shot location and then what was done back in the studio.
Yeah.
And I don't know, but maybe even when they went back to the studio for a second time, because things just weren't marrying together.
But that didn't necessarily just also apply to from scene to scene. Every single scene itself in the beginning, from a wide shot to intercuts to the end, every scene almost felt like it was shot in five different places, partly because it was, but it also, even towards the end of it, after all the effects have been applied to it, you come out of it and feeling that every scene is a mishmash.
Yep.
Reverse angles are a completely different color to other reverse angles.
And the grain, grain a lot between different shots.
I wasn't
shots.
Noticing grain too much, but I was really, I mean, skies were different, you know, were completely different exposures to how they should be. I think, look, I for me, it's a fantasy style that doesn't fit in with quite a realistic sort of backdrop. The stuff that works for me the most is that the real stuff, the stuff that's in camera, a lot of the stuff that works for me is the beautiful, natural, real, unscrewed up cinematography.
That
the fantastic
stuff was gorgeous.
Lighting, just
stuff.
Gorgeous stuff. It's fantastic, but then you're not too far from another effects shot, which it completely takes you back out of the film again. That's half the problem, is I didn't really get to absorb and enjoy an entire film because I spent probably 30% of it snapped out of it. Every time you get immersed into it, bang, there's a shot that just goes, what the hell was that? And you're back out of the film again.
Yeah, so it's a stylistic call there, isn't it? Because if he was going for this kind of fantasy land and with the characters not quite sitting there in the background, then that's really playing off against the story, because you're removed from the story because you're noticing it. Obviously, screen language has developed so much over the years. Effects films are getting flawless.
Yes.
So when we see something look bad, it's really jarring. So yeah. I don't know if that was actually a good point for him or not. And I know that through the process of the effects, just talking to him, because at some stage, you know, you get on a bus in Sydney and you ask the bus driver what he'd been up to these days, and he'd say, you know, I'm comping on Australia. Everyone was comping. So, you know, I think at some stage was it a matter of continuity between the various houses that were doing the shots. And some of the people I spoke to were like, you know, they did a shot and they know that it was fine and it got ticked off by the supers. Yeah. And then when they saw it on the screen, it wasn't quite fine. They'd see a halation around, you know, various parts of the face or clothing or something. They're like, I know when that shot was signed off, it was fine.
Yeah.
And I know the process that was going through with all this, when delivering the shots, they were delivering mats for all the blue screen replacements and stuff. So I don't know, was there some refinessing in the grading stage or something that, you know, offset what was happening in the composite, and then you don't quite get that translation?
It feels like 1,000 elements all done by 1,000 different people. Yep. All put together at the last minute, and by the time they all put it together, they went, oh my god.
Yeah, they felt no craft.
It feels like, unfortunately, you spent 90% of your schedule crafting the edit and going off and doing reshoots, and then the last 10% feels like it was sort of rushed. It's almost like the first time someone saw an answer print projected on a big screen. I know this isn't the case, but this is just purely our impression as third party. It feels like the first time someone really saw the finished thing together and all the effects put together in a row and all the shots in a row was almost like it was too late to go back and change anything. It feels like that the all the element. They spent so much time nursing the edit and getting the story right that ran out of time to finish off the effects, which in a way are so much a part of the story and a lot of it
and
a part of
the
style and the look. I mean, there's a reason that they shot the old classics the way they did. You know, you've got massive cameras the size of a car engine, you know, a truck engine back then, out in the desert or out in, you know, in the wilds. There's a reason why they shot as little as possible, all the sweeping, impossible to recreate wide shots for real on location, and then did as much as possible, and then shot a lot of background plates. And then came back into the studio to do that sort of stuff, because really to get the lighting right and to get, you know, stars looking the way they should, and also just to physically get through the thing,
and
you had to sort of break that up, because, you know, cameras and film gear just wasn't as refined as it is now. But there's a reason that style came out of that way, because they probably ended up doing rear projection or front projection to recreate that style. But in a way, that what would have been great is to do rear or front projection for this.
That would have been great. And I think it would have related to it a lot more. If you're emulating the films of our past, you know, do those techniques. I mean, that would have helped sell a lot. I think also the production, just planning. Obviously, they didn't have mobile phones and the internet when they were doing Gone with the Wind. So their meticulous planning to get them to that point meant you didn't go out and do multiple retakes, and you didn't have, you know, things jarring in the edit because they were shot at two completely different locations and times.
Yeah. Well, look, so, I mean, summing up the what do we think of the overall film part of the thing, I'd say it's definitely something worth seeing. It's a very big, ambitious project that, as I say, some people love, some people hate, but definitely go out and see it, and especially for Australians, go out and support an Australian, and a very ambitious Australian film from someone who's done some fantastic films.
It's a journey and has some beautiful bits in it, but overall for me, it was better than what I thought.
It's one of those films that I'd sort of had to, and there's been a few this year, I think, like that, where I've had to go, people say, what do you think? And I've just literally for 2 days afterwards have not really been able to answer them, because it's taken so long to sort of soak it all up. There's so much there. It's probably a film that I'd need to see again, I could sit through it again.
I think there'll definitely be another director's cut on DVD. Now, obviously, there were some cracking effects in this. I mean, not... I think that we're getting close to 1,500 effect shots,
which is
in the entirety, which is a monster.
Astounding. I always sort of compare that when I hear shot counts on effects reviews, I always sort of go back to Star Wars, which is probably a ridiculously small amount, like 75 shots or, you know, 100 or something ridiculous, and they pulled off the entire Star Wars for, you know, admittedly repeating a few shots, but... pulled that off for such a low shot count. And in these days, you know, when you hear like 1,200,000 sort of shots, I just
well, I think it started
it
actually
astounding.
Started off with several hundred, but it really blew out with the retakes and, you know, having to comp in B-roll stuff of the outback behind Nicole and Hugh. I mean, so that I like to almost ignore all those shots, because while they're, you know, A-B comps and there's still a lot of love and work that goes into those, if we completely disregard those, there's some really good meaty shots in there as well.
Your meaty shots, Matt?
Oh, I love the post bombing of Darwin. I mean, for me, they were some of the better ones in the film. The burning embers and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, that would have been an absolute challenge to do, because I saw some of the plates and there was smoke in the foreground and background, and, you know, rotoing, you know, wires and rope on the boats and through smoke. And
this is more the after the bombing. This is going over to the island where all the stolen children and the orphans were taken.
Yeah, so
with the Japanese,
when that nighttime scene just after the bombing, and then also the next morning when the boat's coming back, some of the fires there seem to have been raging all day and all night, I have no idea, but they looked good.
A lot of sort of sweeping, burning palms in the background there, which clearly they couldn't have done. That a lot of that all looked fantastic. There's a lot of when they come back on the sailboat past all the warships, that's a lot
of
beautiful matting there. It looks fantastic, and a lot of that. And I think as a whole scene, the whole end scene with King George on the water tank, and that whole sort of final David Wenham death scene, sorry, spoiler alert, this is one. Just know these are spoiler alert. Never watch one of, never listen to one of these podcasts without knowing it's going to be a spoiler alert. But that whole sequence, in a way, because it was so uncluttered with matte paintings and effects work, it really sort of flowed and played out well as a scene, because it was just came down to pure filmmaking. There was nothing really in there to take me out of the film. So yeah, that all worked really well at that side of things. But before that, obviously before that, there's a massive should we jump back to the beginning of the film? The first little thing that sort of I thought was great but then not quite great was the first sort of effect stuff of the whole film is as they're traveling to Faraway Downs, traveling to the homestead. There's quite a funny scene where they're being followed in the car by a group. I don't know what the collective noun of ruse is.
Mob.
A mob. Excellent, thank you. A mob of ruse, which looked entirely photoreal, looked fantastic, but there was just something about their jumping cycle wasn't quite... Something about it, just physics wasn't quite right there, but they looked right. It's just that something about the... What did you think of it? You quite liked the ruse.
No, that whole scene just is atypical of his vaudevillian style, you know, Nicole Kidman turning to the camera and screaming, which, you know, made me jump.
I liked that. I thought
the
humour
of the
really
guys
well.
On top of the truck just laughing about it.
Yeah, that all worked really well. I thought all of that travelling stuff, all of that process stuff was really good on the car.
Really?
I thought the green screen stuff all held up pretty well.
I wasn't so happy with that bit. There's no light wrap around the edges. You could see the defining edges of like the dog's face and Nicole's veil that she's wearing over. There's no light coming through the veil and it's got a harsh edge.
See, I think that's probably a case of where the fact that the scene itself I thought worked really well and a lot of the characters were working well and the people up on the top of the bus and the humour of the ruse getting shot. Was it shot? Hit by the car? Yeah, it got shot. That I sort of... transported me that enough to sort of forego the old little soft matte line. Nothing compared to some of the stuff that we're seeing later on, which completely took me out of the film. But I felt that all that process stuff was really well, worked really well, considering probably the only real stuff was probably wide shots of it heading down the road, and the rest of the car cab interiors were all green screen in the studio. That's a testament to a lot of this stuff. Is a testament to Mandy Walker's fantastic cinematography that is so hard to light, your interior green screen or studio green screen stuff to match something that may not have even been shot yet, or matching something that you're playing back on set off a DVD. So I think it was definitely
a challenging film.
I think
in that
all of the stuff that doesn't map right is nothing to do with the cinematography. I think a lot of it is just in so straight out comping. But as I say, we're sort of skipping the whole comping.
I don't even know if it's to do with the comping. There's something somewhere. There's a ghost in the machine that just is not delivering what I was hoping for. Look, I completely buy that, especially that car scene. It had a particular tone, a style, and the comping and the, you know, forgoing the nasty edges does fit in there. It's like, for me, Hancock, you know, the first couple of flying scenes in Hancock, you see that they're not the best things on earth. It's kind of like Greatest American Hero throwback. And so you buy that and you're willing to ride that for the rest of the film. But I was willing to buy those comps for inside the traveling scene there.
Mm.
3 hours of that.
That was the best stuff. That was the best sort of in terms of the effects for me. I mean, I think so. Obviously, when we get to the homestead, when we eventually get to the homestead, there's apart from a lot of sort of comped in conversations that was happening out the front, we did start to get into cattle herds and things like that, which I thought. For me, I thought there was massive amounts of cattle. Obviously, a lot of it was CGI, and there was a huge stampede scene, which was where they're stampeding along the ravine, which sort of started my Indy 4 with cows train of thought. Some of it was equally as well matted as Indy 4 was.
Yeah. Before we get to the ravine part, let's finish up with the house part, with even the comps with King George on the hill laying the fires and stuff going into the night.
Yeah.
That stuff just really wasn't sitting in for me. And even if they wanted it to pop out and be kind of amateurish, it exceeded that too well.
I think in a way that is part of that Moulin Rouge mindset, that visually it's if that kind of sort of almost forced perspective or
that
kind of sort of forced depth would perfectly sit well within that sort of whole Moulin Rouge feel. But there's something about that this, again, harking back to the reality of this, that when you've got sort of such beautiful, sweeping, real landscapes, and you intercut this totally surreal and stylized yeah. shots, it sort of sometimes it doesn't sit. If the whole film had been like that, then you'd totally be along for the ride. But it's this popping in and out of that style, I think, for me.
Did you notice issues of scale and position with various things, like various mountain ranges at the beginning and also the boats at the end? Did you notice the scales going up and down for dramatic effect?
Not so much, no. I wasn't really. I think maybe scales was possibly the least of issues.
I noticed it a little, but some more than others kind of made me, wait a minute, that doesn't seem quite right. And I'm all for, cheating with that kind of forced perspective scale thing to add humour and style, but yeah, when it takes you out of the film again, is it the right thing to do?
Before the cattle herding, there was a whole bunch of interaction on the front step. A lot of it looked like it was racked, or there was a lot of, the first time it almost looked like, the first time I saw Hugh matted into background, he had this massive halo around him. I was trying to work out what's going on. There's something really odd about it. And then I was prompted to be told that this is all matted, and this is the start of the matting. It's not just the, cars, interiors and exteriors. It was, there's every whole chunks shot of dialogue out there that was could have been quite easily done on location, which was perhaps it was rethought or rewritten dialogue that made them do it for real. I couldn't see any other reason for doing these shots separated like that other than a change of dialogue.
Yeah, I kind of thought, okay, there's going to be one or two of them, but when I realized we're in through an entire film of this, I was getting myself comfy. And not in a comfortable manner. Let's move on to the ravine part. I mean, that particular scene was, I think, mostly done by Framestore, and with the giant herds of cattle going crazy, running away from the fire and the deep ravine that they were running head on into.
Yeah. Look, I thought that whole, there was a lot of sort of stuff with the ravine that didn't work quite right. I mean, I started to overthink it totally psychologically, that just cows just wouldn't really, cows just wouldn't run right on the ravine and then run off the cliff. And the cows themselves are all fantastic. There's something about ravines then I just sort of didn't quite, there's always that thing about, if a camera is put in a completely impossible position, then the shot immediately becomes, you don't buy it.
Yep.
You have to be all shot on helicopter. That's the problem with indie. There's a lot of sort of shots where it's just impossible to get shots
kind of shots drive me crazy.
Just because CGI will let us put the camera there doesn't mean
you should.
We should. Mm. Just because we can. So, But
what did you think about the animation of the herd, for example,
and the particles of the dust and all that? Yeah, I thought that was all pretty good, didn't you? I liked all the herd, and that was all great. Particularly static shots when you're looking out over, at the homestead, you can see herds of cattle in their pens.
Yep.
And there was all integrated, just a lot of dust. And it's, maybe there was sort of possible overuse of dust to hide some... hide issues, but there's probably a lot of stuff to contend with, but putting that in there, and I thought the cows were pretty good.
Well, they actually shot an extensive amount of various effects elements and plates, everything from explosions and dust, and I think a lot of the post houses were using those. Some were using some sprite based parts, and I know Uhura down in Melbourne, I think they were using Fume, which is a VFX plugin for 3D Max, to do a lot of their fires and smoke elements. I think mostly in the Darwin kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Overall, I was quite impressed by the dust, because there would have been an awful lot of it, a lot of dust and smoke going in and out, especially when you've already got that element in the plates, in the foreground and background.
I don't know, because theoretically, if you're matting stuff in, there's probably a rule would probably don't start shooting stuff with
that
dust.
Is a
keep
rule,
the dust
yeah,
down to
you
minimal.
Kind of want that, but I don't think that was always the case with this. I know there was a lot of stuff that had in-camera particles, which, having to recreate that depth later on after putting all your other elements in. Especially, again, hopping back to the end of the film with the boat coming back into the harbour. I mean, that looked great. That was an example of a really well-done effect.
Yeah. The I guess the next sort of thing I've got on my list is the after the cattle stampede, or maybe it's before, I can't remember structurally where it sits, but there's this night sort of scene where they're singing to the cattle to sort of calm them down. It's just...
You felt like you were in a set there, didn't you?
I just felt utterly unrealistic. It really felt to me like the end scene on the beach in Contact on another planet, where the skies are amazing exposure and nothing felt real. Again, it comes down to the fact that this sort of quite fantasy or quite stylized imagery is being placed into a real film. That's what sort of snapped me. I mean, if it was in context of another film, it would probably fit in fine, but it didn't. There's a lot of... That's definitely where there was a lot of that sort of weird force perspective where foreground plates didn't match Blazing Saddles. It was very, very Blazing Saddles. You did expect to start, you know, cracking out the beans.
Yeah. Actually, I think some of the shots were better in Blazing Saddles. But, I guess it's just the tonal qualities just marrying between the foreground and background. You know, again, was it a stylized thing? Was it handed back to the grading with the separation mats and then things were retweaked? We'll never know.
Yeah, no, I guess we'll never know. And again, with all this, I really feel sort of bad sort of slamming a lot of this stuff. This is like, you know, years of work for some people, and I just, or was it? Maybe it was weeks.
Well, there was an awful lot of shots. There was an awful large rush. And this time when the rush was on, I don't know if it was all the studio's pressure to get it out on time or whether or not it was lack of planning to get it to that point. If you keep going to do reshoots, you're obviously going to be having new effect shots which have to be done by a certain time. So
there was certainly a lot in the jumping back to the actual film itself for a second, but there was an awful lot of press at the time of cutting down to the wire of it about to be released. Could it be, maybe it was just some kind of fancy PR to talk up the release of the film?
But every
will Baz
film
cut
does
it this
that.
Way? Which ending will we go with? He shot four. What will it be? Does Baz have final cut? Does he not? It's was very sort of hyped last minute part of the film, which if you believed it all, almost led you to believe that they were cutting the film, you know, that the cement was still drying in the gate, you know, as it was being, you know,
it happens,
driven to the cinema. So I don't know, that would certainly make sense.
I've seen the ending of a film change as Reel 4 was going to print.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, ending wise that all worked really well. I don't have an awful lot of problem with the end and the way it all worked out. But yeah, I'm sure there'll be a DVD with five versions on it.
Yeah,
the whole trampled, half buried in the ground Jack Thompson death scene was kind of funny. I actually quite like Jack Thompson's character in this film. It was quite funny to see him pretty spectacular, you know.
For those members,
there's
of
some
our
good deaths in this film.
For those members of our international audience, Jack Thompson is a renowned Australian actor for playing, you know, the U-Butte, She'll Be Right Mate kind of male Australian hero. No, not quite. But I actually found the cameo of just about every single Australian male actor ever born in this film.
Yeah, pretty much.
Russell wasn't in there, and Guy Pearce wasn't in there. But apart from that, Russell was actually supposed to be in the lead, but for some reason wasn't.
To be
there.
Drover.
He was. Can you imagine him as Drover?
I don't know. Maybe it might have added a little bit more personality to it. I'm hopping back to the beginning, you know, I've never really. The whole Nicole and Hugh to me have never really sort of been top of my list in terms of, you know, being totally believable, immersive performers.
No, we could have another whole show here about performance and
that's right.
And
that's not,
people we but, love and hate. But we're talking effects here, and moving on into Darwin pre-bombing and maybe some of the nighttime stuff. Some of the matte paintings at night, what were you thinking of matte paintings? I mean, there was an awful lot of matte paintings throughout the entire thing, some digital, some photographic.
That whole, the pre-bombing, I thought that was all okay. There's nothing that I remember sort of standing out or taking me out of the film.
One that really took me out of the film was in the evening just before the storms happen, and they go down by the side of the dock of the bay, and they're having a bit of a canoodle. And in the background, we see the pier go out, and you know, this perfect circle around all the lamps going up the pier.
Right.
Just no shimmer, no
flare. Atmos. You mean, or halation, or whatever.
They were just big round balls.
Oh, okay. And the painting of the painting, of the lights. Right.
It was, you know, a perfect glass matte painting. Yeah. Kind of thing. But the thing that upset me was the water in the background was perfectly still with lightning going in the sky, no major reflection on the water, until the next shot we cut to, you know, a slightly closer shot of Hugh, and there's the water rippling and moving behind him.
Yeah, right. Again, that's probably part of, you know, one house did the comping of one shot, and another house was handling the matte painting, and then really by the time they all bolted all together, it was too late to go and change one or the other elements to make it all match.
Yeah, I just find those things jarring. I mean, it's maybe it was a deliberate choice to do that kind of thing, but...
Look, I mean, it's the same. If you look at that up the old style, you know, the background plates never really matched the wides, but that was probably unintentional.
Yeah, well... Back in the old days, just because they had
and
to,
you couldn't change
would
it.
They well, have changed
you,
it?
Well, once you did front projection or rear projection, that's one good thing about sort of green, or as you say, blue screen, that you know, you can go back and change these elements later. That's why, you know, directors, we just love that kind of being able to sort of change things later. Thing foreground, rear projection or front projection, really, you know, once you shot it, it's those two bits are bolted together. You get a great look. It looks fantastic. It's wonderful stuff to play with. It has a real interesting style to it, but there's no changing it later.
Well, moving into the 20th century with the idea of projection and matte painting and stuff, I know one technique that was used a lot was 3D projecting of the 2D surfaces onto 3D geometry, and then rendering that off, and then going back and reapplying more matte texturing to it, so you've kind of got that global illumination feel of, you know, depth and texture of the buildings, and then going back and putting more of an analog kind of feel.
Well, so where was that used?
A lot of the stuff in Darwin.
Right.
I know Animal Logic and Allura in Melbourne were doing a lot of stuff between them, but they were sharing assets of Darwin.
Yep.
Animal Logic did the amazing stuff pre-bombing, and Allura did all other stuff post-bombing. Right. Obviously, there's a lot of work to take the pre-bombing asset and then degrading it with, you know, ashes and embers and fires and twisted metal and things like that. But, that kind of projection of textures and stuff, I thought worked really well. And some great assets in there.
Yeah, look, I think in terms of, you know, the building-wise, and I guess you're talking about sort of more structures.
Yep.
Yeah. No, I think that was all great. I think, in a way, and this is not, you know, obviously a criticism of people who are actually doing the matte paintings, this, you know, comes more from the top, is that in a lot of that stuff, there was a tendency to put too much in. You know, in a way, once you sort of crowd a film with the foreground element and the background element, again, this comes back to the just because you can doesn't mean you should kind of mentality. But there's a lot of stuff where it just has... And that can take you out of the film too. Just a simple shot like that, a matte painting, which basically has too much. A ship and another ship and someone in the foreground, and then, you know, the birds flying and sun flare shooting star
shots.
Or whatever. There's a lot of that sort of, you know, there's a few shots there where they just really just tried to put too much. And again, yes, that's a bad thing, and then that's just a stylistic thing sometimes. Again, that's trying to put a style on a film that maybe...
Well,
I
know a lot of the matte painting started off as simple, you know, card mats to go in the back and extend.
Yeah.
But as new shots were picked up and the story kept changing and editing kept happening, those actually had to turn into, you know, projection matte paintings, and we needed an extra angle or something that originally with the camera wasn't going to be tracking a painting.
Projection matte painting versus...
So you've got one matte painting that just goes in as a card.
Yep.
You know, there's a matte painting person in front of it kind of thing. And then another one with projecting is when the camera is moving on a different axis to the foreground relative. So you're kind of, you need to see a different side,
yes.
So of a building.
Right.
So if you go around a corner, you're no longer just seeing that one
trying
side.
Trying to add a perspective or a camera move to
a
parallax
2D
shift,
object. You now need to have it giving you that sympathetically.
Yes, right. No, I get it. So, essentially you're trying to do something with a matte painting that wasn't originally sort of drawn or created with that intent.
Instead of building as many 3D models, building geometry and then putting textures on the side of it. So.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, camera mapping.
Look, yeah, I didn't have the whole Darwin thing. Now, I guess moving on to Darwin, then we go into the full-on attack of Darwin, which you know itself was pretty impressive. There's a lot of units working there. There's a lot of cameras there. There's splinter units. There's a lot of stuff in that attack. A lot of footage going on in there. What did you think of the whole Darwin attack?
Honestly, I felt disappointed because I was hoping, well, it might not be accurate for another Pearl Harbor. I love that scene in Pearl Harbor. It was just, you know, 15 minutes of action-packed fun of fighters and guns and cool angles. I felt it was kind of done cheaply, but well. I guess they were probably, you know, pushed for budget and went, how can we cover this as we can with a low budget? And I think they did a pretty good job. I know one thing they used was some shots from the original footage of Tora, Tora, Tora.
Yes, I saw where they're taking off from the aircraft carrier. There's something funny with that.
It's interesting because
I didn't know it was originally from Tora, Tora, Tora. I sort of found out later on.
It did
kind of
stick out, didn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like the aircraft changed spec. It started off one... It's almost as they took off, they changed somehow. I don't know. There was something odd with that sort of the original... Yeah.
Well, the Tora, Tora, Tora Zeros weren't actually historically accurate. So I think the houses were... Because they were going to put some of the Tora, Tora, Tora footage in, actually changed the models to maybe not be so authentic,
yes,
but focus on what they already had to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, they really looked like they changed from, you know, from one particular aircraft to another, or changed from being real to 3D, or it really, there was something quite odd about the takeoff shot, and I just again, it just kind of popped, whoa.
There's some great shots though, the planes flying over Darwin, dropping the bombs.
There's some fantastic
great
flybys.
Particles of explosions and fire and all that.
And then there's the odd shot where they're just, whoa, wacko motion blur that made them look completely un-CGI. So it really, for every sort of three or four fantastic flyover shots, there was one just bang, again, took me right out of the film. I know I was watching it with an eye to do sort of, you know, to talk about effects later, but I really did try and put the viewer hat on and you know, and just watch it as a film. But I just,
maybe again, that was an intentional thing.
I was being stopped constantly every few shots.
Well, do you think that was an intentional thing of, like, as soon as they started getting things looking too good, too real, they needed to put something in there just to jar you and go, wait, no, it's a cheesy film.
Yeah. Just to keep sort of saying, no, don't, this isn't
real. Don't
get
too comfortable. Yep.
This isn't real. Yeah, like, I don't know.
That's my thought. I'm going to stick with it. I just can't believe that, you know, the
I have had a couple
community
of beers,
can let
though.
This film happen. Oh, I wish I had have had a couple of beers.
Maybe I needed another one. Maybe I needed more.
Okay, well, moving on with the Darwin and the attack scene, and what did you think of post-Darwin? Because I really did... That for me, after the bombing and all that, everything started to look perfect. All the matte paintings seemed to fit in nicely. The smoke, the atmosphere was bang on.
Again, in a way, I think that whole act started to pare back a bit. I mean, I guess... heading off to the island and all that sort of stuff looked very fantastic. There wasn't a lot of effects going on. There was no real sort of flyovers.
Yeah,
it was really, yeah, it started to come back into sort of filmmaking mode. And there was a lot, I'm guessing, at the island there when they're rescuing the kids, there's a lot of matted in flaming palm trees, the background, which obviously you couldn't set a whole sort of jungle alight, but that all of that stuff was fantastic. I was conscious of it because I was looking at it because it looked fantastic, but it didn't sort of take me out of the film. There was I really liked that whole, it was quite good, you know, it was great filmmaking. And then coming back onto the mainland
with the burning sinking boats and
where it's sort of the aftermath. The only thing I thought was really weird, and that's an art directing thing, there was this massive crater in the middle of it, and this truck was in it, a truck,
yes,
a huge army truck in the crater. I think, hang on, did they accidentally back this truck into the crater and leave it there after it was bombed? Because if it was there when the bomb hit, that would have totally destroyed that truck. It was really kind of a really odd art department thing. That really kind of gone, what the? Yeah, dear. But look, I mean,
you'd be someone who didn't care about effects and filmmaking sitting next to us, wouldn't you?
Put the truck in the crater, but the truck's beautifully painted and fresh and clean. Don't matter. No, look, I think, as you say, it did come back. It returned almost to real filmmaking, and there was a great sort of, you know, story, and the whole plot sort of kept going. And it was, I thought it was really revolved around sort of story and wasn't really being, you know, screwed up with too much going on.
Yep.
So, yeah, look, that was the main takeout for me. That I think that's maybe what made that last act, you know, really for a lot of people feel like it was
the film we were expecting.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the more technical natures of the aspect, because I think it's interesting the combination of pipelines. Obviously, there are 13, I counted 13 effects houses in the end credits, and I know there might have been a couple of extra shots done here, there, and everywhere by, you know, either Baz Mark's own company and own little setup, and I think one of the other film companies actually had a couple of suites going with Nuke and Shake here, there, and everywhere, because everyone, as I said, even the bus drivers were comping a couple of shots on the film.
And they would all have their own separate workflows and trying to mat it all together. So I guess when you talk about the possibly limited finishing off, you know, post schedule they would have had, it is phenomenal, you know, effort to gather all of this stuff from, and from the editors and all that sort of point of view, to gather all of this information from all the post houses and get it together into one film.
And across the country and across the world as well, which is always tricky, trying to supervise that many things. I mean, that's why I think James Price came on later in the film. Originally, Chris Godfrey was the VFX supervisor, and he's credited by himself as the VFX supervisor. But James Price also came on board because the volume of the shots just increased to such an exponential number that, you know, they needed someone else to come on board and help keep there would consistency happening.
There would be that sort of point where the effects supervisor, you'd have to sort of creatively farm it all off to the individual houses creatively, and really almost that person becomes, you know, really does become a coordinator, not so much creatively overseeing, but just literally keeping everything flowing, keeping stuff
heading
on
to the end.
You know, getting, yeah, exactly, all meeting at the same point would be a phenomenal effort.
And there's a big mishmash of, you know, gear used. I know Animal Logic, who's in Sydney, and I think they've also got a base over in LA now, they predominantly use Maya and Nuke for their pipelines to, you know, pump the whole thing through, whereas Allura, who also did an awful lot of stuff, works in Max and uses Shake. So just keep those, sharing assets between those two facilities of the Darwin assets and things like that, and just getting that workflow to work, I think was quite well done.
So knowing what sort of what pipelines is suited to what kind of work, did the right houses kind of get the right scenes, do you think? I mean, is a Shake pipeline more suited to something versus a Maya or...
Yeah, well, I was speaking to some friends down at Allura, and they were saying that they found coming out of Max allowed them, especially when they were using like the Fume plugin, to get that volumetric kind of sim of the smoke and fire and things like that.
Yeah,
That was a great plugin.
Was fantastic. I mean, it's obviously
they're finding that rendered faster in Max.
Well, the test of it, I suppose, is that I didn't actually see too much fake fire. I couldn't actually tell. Not that I was really looking, which is great. It didn't stand out to me as being any fake fire, so I couldn't really sort of tell what was created and what was in camera and what wasn't. So I guess that's the test of good effects.
I think they were doing a lot of pre-comps in Fusion, coming straight out of Max, and then sending it over to Shake to, you know, get some camera distortion, things like that, to help the process go through.
So what I constantly find amazing is that just to get one effect, that there is like five
so
bits
many hats.
Of kit and four people who specialize in eight different platforms and all working on the one shot, you know. So yeah, that's that alone for each particular, just in one house, is I find always find amazing that there's five disciplines just for one all working together on one 48 frame shot or whatever.
Yeah, and I guess it's critical for scenes to go to individual effects houses to keep that continuity happening. Well, because I don't know whether or not, I know speaking to various people around the country, some they would seem to do a couple of shots in the middle of seeing that someone else was doing, which I didn't quite understand.
Think, yeah, again, that comes back to me sort of thinking some of the scenes really did feel like they're all shot in five different places, or all originated in five different places. One reverse, you know, maybe someone against a rock wouldn't get the comping, versus the reverse angle of, you know, Hugh against the sky might go to another house, and then, you know, they get mated up together literally probably somewhere at the last minute. So, yeah.
That might be one of the reasons why they're all giving mats back to the grade to, you know, help sell them all together.
Right.
Overall, what were your thoughts?
I'd say go see it, especially, as I say, for Australians, go support it. It's a very interesting film. It's a very ambitious film. There's a lot in it. There's a lot in it to like. I really actually came out of it thinking that Hugh and Nicole were actually really quite good together. That worked well. Actually did have a bit of chemistry, if that's possible.
Yeah.
She looks gorgeous, and the Australian outback has never looked better. It's fantastic photography. The real rawness of it is great. There is some, you know, some amazing scenes, and yeah, I suppose for overall, I'd say, don't judge for yourself. Don't be swayed by effects, but don't be swayed by reviews rather, because it's definitely polarized people, and
that's always a good sign of a film.
I think so, yeah. Look, you know, hey, there's films that my mum has hated that I've loved, and vice versa. You know, even your own family is no sort of real judge. Go, yeah, I think, yeah, it's one of those judge for yourself things. It's definitely,
it's,
I think, any film that actually when you walk away actually makes you think about it.
Yep, it's got to be a good thing.
Rather than some films that just, you know, quite forgettable. You've walked out of it and you don't even, no one even bothers to ask you, what do you think?
It did some risky things, you know, with the style and just the storytelling nature of the whole beast that it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's worth seeing just to see a film that, you know, tries to do something different.
Yeah, exactly right, exactly right. So, 4 marks from that point of view.
Well, I think that's just about it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Jason. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Matt. Pleasure.
And a big thank you to Kristen, our wonderful producer, who works tirelessly behind the scenes to make us sound a hell of a lot better than what we actually do.
Not easy.
No, an awful lot of work right there. But if you want to join us next time, we'll be reviewing Daywatch. And I think Mike will be back for that one as well. And he'll be joined by Igor, a wonderful Ukrainian filmmaker who has done a hell of a lot of research on this next film. So I'm looking forward to that one myself. Now, Jason, if anyone needs to find you out there in webland, where can they find you?
Probably best on Twitter, twitter.com/Wingrove, or my website, jasonwingrove.com.
Excellent. And I'm always over at fxphd.com. Thank you for listening, everyone, and we will catch you next time. Don't forget to check out the website for more reviews and wonderful news at www.vfxshow.com.